Chapter 11. He crouched behind the parapet, at the far edge of the old observatory from the single approaching plane. Behind him, down a steep slope, were bushes and trees and a collection of roofless, overgrown buildings. He watched the aircraft come closer, checked for more coming from other directions, but couldn't find any. Inside the suit, watching the transmitted view, he frowned as the aircraft came closer, slowing all the time, its obese arrowhead shape silhouetted against the sunset as it approached. He watched it drop slowly towards the observatory platform. A ramp hinged from the craft's belly. Three legs flexed out. He took some effector readings from the machine, then shook his head, ducked, and ran back down the slope. Soldrin was sitting in one of the ruined buildings. He looked surprised when the suited figure entered through the creeper-choked doorway.
"Yes, Sheridanin?"
"It's a civilian craft," he said, pushing the faceplate up.
He was grinning.
"I don't think it's looking for us after all. Might still provide an escape route, though."
He shrugged.
"Worth a try." He gestured back up the slope. "You coming along?" Soldrin Beishai looked through the dusk at the matte black figure in the doorway. He had been sitting here wondering what he ought to do, and had not yet come up with any answers. Part of him just wanted to get back to the peace and quiet and certainty of the university library, where he could live happily, without fuss, ignore the world, and immerse himself in the old books, trying to understand ancient ideas and histories, hoping to make sense of them one day, and perhaps explain his own ideas, try to point out the lessons of these elder histories, hoping to make sense of them one day, and perhaps explain his own ideas, try to point out the lessons of these elder histories, perhaps make people think again about their own times and ideologies. For a time, for a long time there, it had seemed entirely and definitely the most worthwhile and productive thing he could do. But he was not sure of that any longer. Perhaps, he thought, there were more important things to be done which he could have a hand in. Perhaps he ought to go with Zakalwi as the man and the culture wanted. Could he just relapse back into his studies after this? Zakalwi, coming back from the past, as rash and brash as ever. Ubrel, could she really have been? Just acting a part? Making him feel very old and foolish now, but angry as well? And the whole cluster, drifting rudderless towards the rocks, all over again? Did he have any right not to try and do something? Even if the culture was wrong about his stature in the civilization. He didn't know. He could see that Zakalwi had tried to appeal to his vanity, but what if even half of what he said was true? Was it right to sit back and just let things happen, however much it might be, the easiest, least stressful course? If there was a war, and he knew he'd done nothing, how would he feel afterwards? "Damn you, Zakalwi," he thought. He stood up. "I'm still thinking," he said. "But let's see how far you can get."
"Good man."
The suited figure's voice betrayed no obvious trace of emotion. "Extremely sorry for the delay, gentle people. It really wasn't within our control. Some sort of traffic control panic, but do let me apologize again on behalf of Heritage Tours. Well, here we are, a bit later than we expected, but isn't that a pretty sunset? The very famous Srometran Observatory. At least 4,500 years of history have been played out beneath your feet here, gentle people. I'm going to have to fairly rattle through it to tell it all to you in the time we have here, so listen close." The aircraft hovered, AG field buzzing, just above the western edge of the observatory platform. Its legs hung, dangling in mid-air, apparently extended merely as a precaution. About 40 people had disembarked from it down the belly ramp, and now stood around one of the stone instrument plinths, while an eager young tour guide talked to them. He watched through the stone balustrade, scanning the group with the suit's built-in effector, and watching the results on the visor screen head-up. 30-plus of the people were carrying what were in effect terminals, links to the planet's communications net. The suit's computer covertly interrogated the terminals through the effector. Two of the terminals were switched on, one receiving a sports broadcast, another receiving music. The rest were on standby. "Suit?" he whispered. Not that even Soldrin right beside him could have heard him, let alone the people in the tourist group. "I want to disable those terminals, quietly, to stop them from transmitting." "Two receiving terminals are transmitting location code," the suit said. "Can I disable their transmit function without altering their present location code function, or their present reception?" "Yes." "Right. The priority being preventing any further new signals. Disable all the terminals." "Disabling all 34 non-culture personal comnet terminals within range. Confirm?"
"Confirmed."
"Damn it. Do it."
"Order carried out." He watched the head-up alter as the internal power states of the terminals sank back to near zero. The tour guide was leading the people across the stone plateau of the old observatory, towards where he and Beishai were, and away from the hovering aircraft. He shoved the suit faceplate up, looked round at the other man.
"Okay, let's go. Quietly."
He went first, through the undergrowth, between the crowding trees. It was quite dark under the half-fallen foliage, and Beishai stumbled a couple of times, but they made relatively little noise as they trod the carpet of dead leaves round two sides of the observatory platform. When they were under the aircraft, he scanned it with the suit effector. "You beautiful little machine," he breathed, watching the results come up. The aircraft was automatic and very stupid. A bird probably had a more complicated brain. "Suit, patch into the aircraft. Assume control without letting anybody else know. Assuming covert control jurisdiction of single aircraft within range. Confirm?"
"Confirmed.
And stop asking me to confirm everything. Control jurisdiction assumed. Lapsing confirmatory instruction protocols. Confirm?"
"Good grief.
Confirmed. Confirm protocol lapsed." He considered just floating up, holding Beishai into the craft, but even though the aircraft's own AG would probably mask the signal his suit gave off, it might not. He glanced up the steep slope, then turned to Beishai and whispered,
"Give me your hand. We're going up."
The old man did as he asked. They went steadily up the slope, the suit kicking footholds in the earth. They stopped at the balustrade. The aircraft blocked out the evening sky above them, yellow light spilling from the belly entrance above the ramp, faintly illuminating the nearer stone instruments. He checked on the tour group while Beishai got his breath back. The tourists were at the far side of the observatory. The guide was shining a flashlight at some ancient piece of stonework. He stood up. "Let's go," he told Beishai, who straightened. They stepped over the balustrade, walked to the ramp and up into the aircraft. He followed Beishai. He watched the rear view on the helmet screen, but couldn't tell whether anybody in the tour group had noticed them or not. "Suit, close the ramp," he told the suit, as he and Beishai entered the single large space of the craft's interior. It was ornately luxurious, its walls slung with hangings and its deeply carpeted floor dotted with large chairs and couches. There was an autobar at one end, while the opposite wall was a single huge screen, presently displaying the last of the sunset. The ramp chimed and hissed as it came up. "Suit, retract legs," he said, hinging the suit faceplate back. Happily, the suit was smart enough to realize he meant the aircraft's legs, not its own. It had occurred to him that somebody might just be able to leap onto one of the craft's legs from the observatory balustrade. "Suit, adjust aircraft altitude up 10 meters. The light buzzing noise around them changed, then settled back to what it had been before. He watched Beshai take off his heavy jacket, then looked round the interior of the craft. The effector said there was nobody else aboard, but he wanted to make sure. "Let's see where this thing was headed next," he said, as Beshai sat down on a long couch, sighing and stretching. "Suit, the aircraft's next destination?" "Gypline Space Terminal," the clipped voice told him. "That sounds perfect. Take us there, suit, and make it look as legal and normal as possible." "Underway," the suit said. "ETA, 40 minutes. The craft's background noise altered, climbing in pitch. The floor moved just a little. The screen on the far side of the large cabin showed them moving out across the wooded hills, rising into the air. He took a walk round the craft, confirming there was nobody else aboard, and then sat by Beshai, who he thought looked very tired. It had been a long day, he supposed. "Are you all right?" "I'm glad to be sitting down, I'll say that." Beshai kicked off his boots. "Let me get you a drink, Soldren," he said, taking off the helmet and heading for the bar. "Suit," he said, suddenly struck by an idea. "You know one of the culture's downlink numbers in Solitol?" "Yes. Connect with one via the aircraft." He bent down, looking at the autobar. "And how does this work?" "The autobar is voice... Zakalwe!" Smar's voice cut across that of the suit, making him start. He straightened. "Where are..." the woman's voice said, then paused. "Oh, you've got yourself an aircraft, have you?" "Yes," he said. He looked across to where Beshai was watching him. "On our way to Gypline Port." "So what happened? Where's that module?" "And Smar, I'm hurt. You haven't called. You haven't written. Sent flowers." "Is Beshai all right?" Smar said urgently. "Soldrin's fine," he told her, smiling at the other man. "Suit, get this autobar to fix us a couple of refreshing but strong drinks." "He's okay, good." The woman sighed. The autobar made clicking, gurgling noises. "We haven't called," Smar said, "because if we had, we'd have let them know where you were. We lost the tight link when the capsule got blasted." "Sir Calby, that was ridiculous. It was pure chaos after the capsule wasted the truck in the flower market and you downed that fighter. You're lucky you made it as far as you did. Where is the capsule anyway?"
"Back at the observatory."
"Sirometron," he said, looking down as a hatch opened in the autobar. He took the tray with the two drinks on it over to Beshai, sat down at his side. "Smar, say hello to Soldren Beshai," he said, handing the other man his drink.
"Mr. Beshai," Smar's voice said from the suit.
"Hello," Beshai said.
"Pleased to talk to you, Mr. Beshai. I do hope Mr. Zakalwe is treating you all right. Are you well?"
"Tired, but hale."
"I trust Mr. Zakalwe has found time to communicate to you the seriousness of the political situation in the cluster."
"He has," Beshai said. I am certainly considering doing what you ask, and for the moment have no urge to return to Solitol."
"I see," Smar said. "I appreciate what you say. I'm sure Mr. Zakalwe will do all he can to keep you safe and well while you're deliberating, won't you, Sharadinin?"
"Of course, Dizier."
"Now, where's that module?"
"Stuck under the cloud tops of Sororoth, or where it was before. Thanks to your Nova profile escapades down there, everything's on maximum alert. We can't move anything without being seen, and if we're seen to be interfering, we might start the war all by ourselves. Describe where that capsule is again. We're going to have to passive spot it from the microsatellite and then blast it from up here to remove the evidence. Shit. This is messy, Zakalwey.
Well, pardon me, he said.
He drank again. The capsule's under a large yellow-leaf deciduous tree between 80 and 130 meters northeast of the observatory. Oh, and the plasma rifle's about 20 to 40 meters due west.
You lost it?
Smar sounded incredulous. Threw it away in a fit of pique, he admitted, yawning. It got effectorized.
Told you it belonged in a museum,
another voice interrupted.
Shut up, Scaffin Antiskor, he said.
So, Smar, what now? Gipline, space terminal, I suppose, the woman replied. We'll see if we can book you on something outgoing. For Impren, or nearby. At worst, you've got a civilian trip ahead of you of weeks at least. If we're lucky, they'll stand down the alert and the module can sneak out and rendezvous. Either way, though, the war may be a little closer, thanks to what happened in Solitol today. Just think about that, Zakalwey. The channel closed.
She sounds unhappy with you, Sharadanin, Veshai said.
He shrugged.
No change there, he sighed.
I'm really most terribly sorry, gentle people. This has never happened before. Never. I really am sorry. I just can't understand it. I'll try...
The young man hit buttons on his pocket terminal.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
He shook it, banged it with the heel of his hand.
This is this has never, never happened before. It really hasn't.
He looked apologetically up at the people in the tour group, clustered round the single light. Most of the people were looking at him. A few were trying their own terminals with no more success than he, and a couple were watching the western sky as though the last red smudge there would give up the aircraft that had so mysteriously decided to leave of its own accord.
Hello? Hello? Anybody, please reply!
The young man sounded almost in tears. The very last dreg of light left the sunset sky. Moonglow lit up some thinner patches of cloud. The flashlight flickered.
Anybody at all? Please reply. Oh, please.
Scaffin Antiskor got back in touch a few minutes later to say that he and Beshai had cabins reserved on a clipper called the Awesome Emaninish, heading for Breskiel system, just 3 light-years from Impren. The hope was that the module would get to them before that. It would probably have to. Their trail would almost certainly be picked up.
It might be an idea for Mr. Beshai to alter his appearance, the drone's smooth voice told them.
He looked up at the wall drapes.
I suppose we could try and make some clothes out of stuff here, he said doubtfully. The aircraft baggage hold might prove a more fruitful source of attire, the drone's voice purred, and told him how to open the floor hatch. He surfaced with 2 suitcases, wrenched them open.
Clothes, he said.
He took some out. They looked sufficiently unisex.
And you'll have to lose your suit and weaponry too, the drone said.
What?
You'll never get on board a ship with all that stuff, Zakalwey, even with our help. You have to pack it all in something, one of those cases would be ideal, and leave it in the port. We'll try and pick it up once the heat's off. But...
Beshai himself suggested they shaved his head when they were discussing how to disguise him. The last use the wonderfully sophisticated combat suit was put to was as a razor. Then he took it off. They both changed into the rather loud but thankfully loose-fitting clothes. The craft landed. The space terminal was a wilderness of concrete, lined off like a game board by the lifts that took craft down to and up from the handling facilities. Tight beam established again, the earing terminal could whisper to him, guide him and Beishai. But he felt naked without the suit. They stepped from the aircraft into a hangar. Pleasantly forgettable music tinkled. Nobody met them. They could hear a distant alarm. The earing terminal indicated which door to take. They moved along a staff-only corridor, through two security doors which swung open for them even before they got to them, then, after a pause, came out into a huge crowded concourse full of people, screens, kiosks, and seats. Nobody noticed them, because a moving walkway had just slammed to a stop, toppling dozens of people on top of each other. A security camera in the left luggage area swung up to look at the ceiling for the minute it took them to deposit the suitcase with the suit in it. The instant they'd gone, the camera resumed its slow sweeping. More or less the same happened when they picked up their tickets at the appropriate desk. Then, while they were walking along another corridor, they saw a party of armed security guards enter from the other end. He just kept on walking. He sensed Beishai hesitate at his side. He turned, smiled easily at the other man, and when he turned back, the guards were stopped, the leading guard holding one hand to his ear and looking at the floor. He nodded, turned, and pointed to a side corridor. The guards set off down it. "We're not just being incredibly lucky, I take it," Beishai muttered. He shook his head. "Not unless you count it as incredibly lucky that we've got a near-military-standard electromagnetic effector controlled by a hyper-fast starship mind working this entire port like an arcade game from a light year or so off. No." They were passed through a VIP channel to the small shuttle that would take them to the orbiting station. The final security check was the only one the ship couldn't rig. A man with practiced eyes and hands. He seemed happy they had nothing dangerous on them. The earring jabbed his ear as they passed down another corridor. More X-rays and a strong magnetic field, both manually controlled, double-checking. The shuttle flight was relatively uneventful. In the station, they passed across one transit lounge. In something of a commotion due to a man with a direct neural implant seemingly having a fit on the floor, straight into a final security check. In the corridor between the lounge lock and the ship, he heard Smar's voice, tiny, in his ear. "That's it, Sir Calloway. Can't tight beam on the ship without being spotted. We'll only contact in a real emergency. Use the Solitol phone link if you want to talk, but remember, it'll be monitored. Goodbye. Good luck." And then he and Beishai went through another airlock, and on the clipper, Awesome Emanenish, which would take them into interstellar space. He spent the hour or so before departure walking round the clipper, just checking it all out, so that he knew where everything was. The speaker system and most of the visible screens announced their departure. The clipper drifted, then dawdled, then raced away from the station. It swung away past the sun and the gas giant Sororoth. Sororoth was where the module was having to keep hidden, 100 kilometers deep in the vast perpetual storm that was the mighty planet's atmosphere. An atmosphere that would be plundered, mined, stripped, and altered by the humanists, if they had their way. He watched the gas giant fall astern, wondered who was really right and wrong, and felt an odd helplessness. He was passing through the bustle of a small bar on his way to check on Beishai, when he heard a voice behind him say, "Ah, sincere hellos and things. Mr. Starabind, isn't it?"
He turned slowly. It was the small doctor from the Scar Party. The little man stood at the crowded bar, beckoning to him. He walked over, squeezing between the chattering passengers. "Doctor, good day." The little man nodded.
"Stapangarda Zlinetere. But call me Stap."
"With pleasure, and even relief." He smiled. "And please call me Sharad."
"Well, small cluster, isn't it? May I buy you a drink?"
He flashed his toothy grin, which, caught in a small spotlight above the bar, glared quite startlingly. "What an excellent idea." They found a small table wedged up against one bulkhead. The doctor wiped his nose, adjusted his immaculate suit.
"So, Sharad, what brings you along on this little jaunt?"
"Well, actually, Stap," he said quietly, "I'm travelling sort of incognito, so I'd appreciate it if you didn't broadcast my name, you know."
"Absolutely," Dr. Stapp said, nodding fiercely.
He glanced round conspiratorially, leaned closer.
"My discretion is exemplary. I've had to travel quietly."
His eyebrows waggled.
"Myself, on occasion. You just let me know if I can be of any help."
"You're very kind." He raised his glass. They drank to a safe voyage.
"Are you going to the end of the line? To Breskial?" Stapp asked.
He nodded. "Yes, myself and a business associate." Dr. Stapp nodded, grinning.
"Ah, a business associate. Ah."
"No, doctor, not a business associate. A business associate. A gentleman. And quite elderly. And in a different cabin. Would that all three descriptions were their opposite, of course."
"Ha! Quite," said the doctor.
"Another drink?" "You don't think he knows anything?" Beshai asked. "What's to know?" He shrugged. He glanced at the screen on the door of Beshai's cramped cabin. "Nothing on the news?" "Nothing," Beshai said. "They mentioned an all-port security exercise, but nothing directly about you or me." "Well, we probably aren't in any more danger because the doc's aboard than we were already."
"How much is that?"
"Too much. They're bound to work out what happened eventually. We'll never get to Breskial before they do."
"Then?"
"Then, unless I can think of something, the culture either has to let us be taken back, or take the ship over, which is going to be tricky to explain, and bound to remove some of your credibility."
"If I decide to do as you ask, Sharadinin."
He looked at the other man, sitting alongside him on the narrow bed. "Yeah. If." He prowled the ship. The clipper seemed cramped and crowded. He'd got too used to culture vessels, he supposed. There were plans of the ship available on screen, and he studied them, but they were really just for people to find their way about, and provided little useful information on how the ship might be taken over or disabled. Judging from watching the crew when they appeared, entry to crew-only areas was by voice and/or handprint match. There was little flammable on board, nothing explosive, and most of the circuitry was optical rather than electronic. Doubtless the xenophobe could make the clipper Awesome Emaninish dance and sing with the effector equivalent of one hand tied behind its back, from somewhere in the next stellar system, but without the combat suit or a weapon, he was going to have a tough job trying to do anything, if and when it came to it. Meanwhile, the clipper crawled through space. Beshai stayed in his cabin, catching up on the news via the screen, and sleeping. "I seem to have swapped one subtle form of imprisonment for another, Sharadinin," he observed, the day after they left,
as the other man brought him supper. "Saldrin, don't go cabin crazy. If you want to go out, go out. It's a little safer this way, but, well, only a little." "Well," Saldrin said, taking the tray and lifting the cover to inspect the contents, "for now it's easy enough to treat the news and current affairs casts as my research material, so I do not feel unduly confined." He set the cover aside. "But a couple of weeks might be asking rather too much, Sheridanin." "Don't worry," he said dejectedly. "I doubt it'll come to that."
"Ah, Sherad!"
The small fussy shape of Dr. Stapp sidled up to him a day later, while people watching a magnified view of an impressive gas giant in a nearby system slide past on the principal lounge main screen. The small doctor took his elbow. "I'm having a small private party this evening in the Starlight Lounge. One of my, special parties, you know. I wondered if you and your hermit-like business partner might like to participate." "They let you aboard with that thing?" he laughed.
"Shh, good sir,"
the doctor said, pulling the other man away from the press of people. "I have a long-standing arrangement with the shipping line. My machine is recognized as being of primary medical importance." "Sounds expensive. You must have to charge a lot, doctor." "Well, there is, of course, a small consideration involved, but well within the means of most cultured people, and I can assure you of some very exclusive company, and complete discretion as ever." "Thank you for the offer, doctor, but I'm afraid not." "It really is the opportunity of a lifetime. You are most lucky to have the chance a second time." "I'm sure. Perhaps if it occurs a third time." "Excuse me." He patted Stapp on the shoulder. "Oh, shall I see you for drinks this evening?" The doctor shook his head. "I'll be setting up. Preparing, I'm afraid, Sherad." He looked somehow plaintive. "It is a great opportunity," he said toothily. "Oh, I'm well aware of that, Dr. Stapp." "You're a wicked man." "Thank you. It's taken years of diligent practice."
"I bet."
"Oh, no. You're going to tell me you're not wicked after all. I can see it in your eyes." "Yes. Yes, it's there. Purity. I recognize the symptoms. But..." He put one hand on her forearm. "Don't worry. It can be cured." She pushed him away, but only with the softest of pressures. "You're terrible." The hand that had pushed him away lingered just for a moment on his chest.
"You're bad."
"I confess. You have seen into my soul." He looked round for a second as the background noise of the ship altered. He smiled back at the lady. But it gives me such succor to confess to one so close to a goddess-like beauty." She laughed throatily, her slender neck exposed as she put her head back. "Do you normally get anywhere with this line?" she asked, shaking her head. He looked hurt, shook his head sadly. "Oh, why are beautiful women so cynical these days?" Then he saw her gaze shift to somewhere behind him. He turned. "Yes, officer," he said to one of the two junior officers he found standing behind him. Both had guns in open holsters. "Mr. Sherad," the young man said. He watched the young officer's eyes and suddenly felt sick. The man knew. They'd been traced. Somebody somewhere had put the numbers together and come up with the right answer. "Yes," he said, grinning rather stupidly. "You guys want a drink?" He laughed, looked round at the woman. No, thank you, sir. Would you come with us, please?"
"What's the matter?"
he said, sniffing, then draining his glass. He wiped his hands on the lapels of his jacket.
Captain needs some help steering the ship,
yeah?
He laughed, slid off his bar stool, turned to the woman, took her hand and kissed it.
My dear lady, I bid you farewell until we meet again.
He put both hands to his chest.
But always remember this. There is forever a piece of my heart that belongs to you.
She smiled uncertainly. He laughed loudly, turned, and bumped into the barstool.
Whoops, he said.
This way, Mr. Sherrad, the first one said.
Yeah, just wherever.
He'd hoped they'd take him into the crew-only section, but when they got into the small lift, they pressed for the lowest deck. Stores, non-vacuum luggage, and the brig.
I think I'm going to be sick,
he said as soon as the doors closed. He bent over, retched, forcing out the last few drinks. One jumped out of the way to keep his shiny boots clean. The other, he sensed, was bending down, putting one hand to his back. He stopped throwing up, slammed one elbow up into the man's nose. He crashed back into the elevator's rear doors. The second man hadn't quite recovered his balance. He straightened and punched him straight in the face. The second one folded, knees, then backside hammering onto the floor. The lift chimed, stopped between decks, its weight limit alarm triggered by all the commotion. He thumped the topmost button and the lift started up. He took the guns from the two unconscious officers. Neural stunners. He shook his head. The elevator chimed again, the floor they'd left. He stepped forward, stuffing the two stun guns into his jacket as he braced his feet in the far corners of the small space, straddling the two men, and pressed his hands against the doors. He grunted with the effort of holding the doors closed, but eventually the elevator gave up the struggle. Still holding the doors with both hands, he twisted his body until he got his head to the topmost button and pressed it with his forehead. The lift hummed upwards again. When the doors opened, three people stood outside on the private lounge level. They looked at the two unconscious guards and the small watery pool of vomit. Then he zapped them with the stun guns, and they fell. He pulled one of the officers half out of the elevator so the lift couldn't close its doors, and used a stun gun on both men too. The Starlight Lounge door was closed. He pressed the button, looking back down the corridor, where the lift doors pulsed gently against the fallen officer's body like some unsubtle lover. There was a distant chime, and a voice said,
"Please clear the doors. Please clear the doors."
"Yes," said the door to the Starlight Lounge. "Stapp, it's Sherrad. I changed my mind."
"Excellent!"
The door opened. He went quickly inside, hit the shut button. The modest lounge was full of drug smoke, low light, and mutilated people. Music played, and all eyes, not all of them in their sockets, turned to him. The doctor's tall grey machine was over near the bar, where a couple of people were serving. He got the doctor between him and the others, stuck the stun gun under the little man's chin. "Bad news, Stapp. These things can be fatal at close range, and this one's on maximum. I need your machine. I'd prefer to have your cooperation, too, but I can get by without it. I'm very serious, and in a terrible hurry, so what's it to be?" Stapp made a gurgling noise. "3, he said, pressing the stun gun a little harder into the little doctor's neck. "2.
All right. This way."
He let him go, following Stapp across the floor to the tall machine he used for his strange trade. He kept his hands together, stun pistols hidden up each sleeve. He nodded to a few people as they passed. He spotted a clear line of fire to somebody on the far side of the room just for an instant. He zapped them. They fell spectacularly onto a laden table. While everybody was looking there, he and Stapp, prodded once to keep going when the crash came from the distant table, got to the machine.
"Excuse me," he said to one of the bar girls. "Will you help the doctor?"
He nodded behind the bar. He wants to move the machine through there, don't you, Doc? They entered the small storeroom behind the bar. He thanked the girl outside, closed the door, locked it, and shifted a pile of containers in front of it. He smiled at the alarmed-looking doctor. You see that wall behind you, Stapp? The doctor's gaze flicked that way. We're going through it, Doc, with your machine. You can't! You... He put the stun gun against the man's forehead. Stapp closed his eyes. A corner of handkerchief protruding from a breast pocket trembled. Stapp, I think I know how that machine must work, to do what it does. I want a cutting field, a slicer that'll take molecular bonds apart. If you won't do it, and right now, I'll put you out and try it myself. And if I get it wrong and fuse the fucker, you're going to have some very, very unhappy customers out there. They might even do what you've done to them, but without the old machine here, hmm? Stapp swallowed. He began. One of his hands moved slowly towards his jacket. My toolkit. He took the wallet of tools out, turned shakily to the machine, and opened a panel. The door behind them chimed. He found some sort of chromed bar utensil on a shelf, moved the containers in front of the door aside. Stapp looked round, but saw the gun was still pointed at him and turned back, and jammed the piece of metal into the gap between the sliding door and its housing. The door gave an outraged chirp, and a red light blinked urgently on the open-close button. He slid the containers back again. "Hurry up, Stapp," he said. "I'm doing all I can," the little doctor yelped. The machine made a deep buzzing noise. Blue light played around a cylindrical section about a meter from the floor. He looked at the section, eyes narrowing. "What are you hoping to do?" the doctor said, voice shaking. "Just keep working, Doc. You have half a minute before I try doing it myself." He looked over the doctor's shoulder, saw him fiddling with a circular control mapped out in degrees. All he could hope to do was get the machine going and then attack whatever parts of the ship he could. Disable it somehow. All ships tended to be complicated, and, to a degree, the cruder a ship was, paradoxically, the more complicated it was too. He just had to hope he could hit something vital without blowing the thing up. "Nearly ready," the doctor said. He looked nervously backwards, one shaking finger going towards a small red button. "Okay, Doc," he told the trembling man, looking suspiciously at the blue light playing round the cylindrical section. He squatted down level with the doctor. "Go on," he nodded. The doctor swallowed. "It might be better if you stood back over there." "No, let's just try it, eh?" He hit the little red button. A hemi-disc of blue light shot out over their heads from the cylindrical section of the machine and sliced through the containers he had stacked against the door. Fluid spurted out of them. The shelves to one side collapsed, supports severed by the humming blue disc. He grinned at the wreckage. If he'd still been standing, the blue field would have cut him in half. "Nice try, Doc," he said. The little doctor slumped to the floor like a pile of wet sand as the stun pistol hummed. Snack packets and drink cartons showered onto the floor from the demolished shelves. The ones falling through the blue beam hit the floor shredded. Drink poured from the punctured containers in front of the door. There was a thumping noise coming from behind the containers. He rather appreciated the heady smell of alcohol filling the store room, but hoped there weren't enough spirits involved to cause a fire. He spun the machine around, splashing through the drink, gradually collecting on the floor of the small storeroom. The flickering blue half-disc cut through more shelves before sinking into the bulkhead opposite the door. The machine shook. The air filled with a teeth-cracking whine, and black smoke spun round against the wrecked shelves as though propelled by the cutting blue light, and then fell quickly to the surface of the sloshing drink filling the bottom decimeter of the storeroom, where it collected like a tiny dark fog bank. He started manipulating the controls on the machine. A little hollow screen showed the shape of the field. He found a couple of tiny joysticks that altered it, producing an elliptical field. The machine thumped harder. The noise rose in pitch and black smoke poured out around him. The thumping from behind the door got louder. The black smoke was rising in the room, and already he felt light-headed. He pushed hard against the machine with his shoulder. It trundled forward, howling. Something gave. He put his back against the machine and pushed with his feet. There was a bang from in front of the machine, and it started to roll away from him. He turned, pushed with his shoulder again, staggering past smoking shelves, through a glowing hole into a wrecked room full of tall metal cabinets. Drinks spluttered through the gap. He held the machine steady for a moment. He opened one of the cabinets to find a glittering mass of hair-fine filaments wrapped round cables and rods. Lights winked on a long, thin control board, like some linear city seen at night. He pursed his lips and made a kissing sound at the fibres. "Congratulations," he said to himself. "You have won a major prize." He hunkered down at the humming machine, adjusted the controls to something like the way Stapp had had them, but producing a circular field, then switched it to full power. The blue disc slammed into the grey cabinets in a blinding maelstrom of sparks. The noise was numbing. He left the machine where it was and waddled away under the blue disc, splashing back into the control room. He eased himself over the still unconscious doctor, kicked the containers away from the door, and removed the metal tool from the door. The blue beam wasn't extending far through the gap from the control room, so he stood up, shoved the door open with his shoulder, and fell out into the arms of a startled ship's officer, just as the field machine blew up and blasted both of them across the bar and into the lounge. All the lights in the lounge went out.